What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
You're listening to Intelligence Squared. Today we hear from politician and writer Shashi Tharoor about the rise of nationalism in India and around the world and his recent new book, The Battle for India's Soul. Here's Rana Mitter with more.
I'm very excited to be hosting this Intelligence Squared Plus event with our guest tonight, Shashi Tharoor. And Shashi is extremely well known as one of the most prominent public intellectuals in India and indeed at a global level. He's a politician, he's a writer, he's a former diplomat, and he has been a member of the Indian Parliament for the Congress Party since 2009. He was formerly Under Secretary General of the United Nations and author of many, many books, both fiction and non-fiction. They include Why I'm a Hindu and the new title that we're going to discuss tonight, The Struggle for India's Soul. Let's get started. Shashi, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to this Intelligence Squared event. Thanks to that and the magic of the pandemic era technology, which of course is something that we are both taking advantage of and in some ways have to regret. Let's hope we're moving out of that stage.
Indeed, very good to be with you. Thank you.
Great to be here. Great to have you here. A struggle for India's soul. So what defines India's soul, Shashi, and why is there a struggle for it in the first place? Why is this an issue?
It's an issue because in many ways what we're seeing in Indian politics today after 75 years of independence is a surprising conflict, a conflict that I think many of us growing up in India in a certain time and indeed reading and writing and studying India would never have anticipated arising so late, as it were, into our political existence. Because, you know, Indian nationalism is something many of us took for granted. There was, of course, anti-colonial nationalism. In my case, it ended in a decade before I was born. But the fact is, that was about getting the foreigners out of India. That was done. And that then evolved into what one would call a civic nationalism. Because the nationalism that inspired our long struggle for independence had always been rooted in India's time-honored civilization traditions of inclusivity, social justice, religious tolerance, a desire to forge a society that allowed individuals to flourish irrespective of their religion, their caste, their language, their place of birth. And that was the nationalism we grew up with. And we saw no contradiction between celebrating our diversity and the variety of everything, of religions, of languages, of regions, of colors, and so on in our country, and at the same time proudly considering ourselves nationalists. Suddenly, this seemingly benign thought of nationalism, which I suppose political scientists would call civic nationalism, has been challenged by a new dominant narrative that has won two elections in a row and that challenges this basic idea of India and which seems to thrive on an exclusionary, aggressive, sectarian spirit based on a sort of cultural identity, the idea that India is a Hindu Rashtra. So in this process, the soul of India, what is it that we celebrate when we call ourselves Indian? What do we feel when we announce our patriotism or our nationalism? This is in question. And the struggle is, are we going to speak of and show allegiance to an India which celebrates civic nationalism and diversity? Or are we now expected to adhere to a notion of India, an idea of India, anchored in ethno-religious identity nationalism, which denounces the rest of us as being anti-national for not subscribing to that vote? That's the fundamental struggle that's going on for India, sir.
All right, Shashi, thanks for that. Let's get to some of the specifics that you mentioned in your book, because I have to say it is a fascinating read and I enjoyed it very much and would encourage others to take it up and read it. One of the One of the distinctions that you make in the book, not your own distinction, I know, one you cite from others who you, I have to say, probably don't agree with, but nonetheless that is made, is between the word Bharat and the term India. Now, at a very literalistic level, of course, this doesn't seem to make sense because those who know Hindi or related languages will know that Bharat just means India. If you're speaking Hindi, that's what it is. And India is the old British name which has come to describe the country. And yet, you argue that there is a distinction being made between these two, and you don't like the distinction. Could you explain why that is?
Right. Well, as you said, Bharat, in fact, the Constitution says India, that is Bharat. So the two are even constitutionally synonymous, and every Indian language refers to India as Bharat, including my mother tongue, Malayalam, and yours, I assume at some point, Bangla, and so on. I mean, every Indian language, not just Hindi, uses the term Bharat. But having said that, what many have taken the two terms as shorthand for is for the Bharat representing something more timeless, primordial, authentic, rooted in the national soil, and India as somehow more deracinated, elitist, Anglophone, and emerging from a colonial construct. I'm troubled by that because it then translates into contemporary India as urban Anglophone elitism in one and rooted Indian language speaking, particularly Hindi speaking, far more sort of Hindu notion of India in the other. And I just think that those binaries are unnecessary and elide the fundamental way in which I believe India's soul embraces diversity and says that all of us belong to it in our own way. So anyway, that's the distinction that you sought. It's not a distinction I welcome, but it is indeed often resorted to by analysts.
Well, I want to probe a little while into some of the ways in which those divisions are becoming more evident in the India of today and what they mean for the country's future. Let's just get a few specific examples. I suspect that many of those who've tuned in today either, you know India well or are interested in some sense, but just to get a bit of a picture, civil society is one of the areas where those observing India who have concerns about where things are going, where things seem to have in some ways closed off or become more constrained than they were previously. Universities, the media, these are what people talk about when they're looking, as it were, from a previously more liberal settlement to one that seems to have gone in a more monolithic direction. Could you give any examples of anything that you are worried about in those areas?
Oh, my God, that's almost the entire book there, Rana.
Well, we've already got an hour, so perhaps I want to get something concrete, in other words, into people's minds of things that you think that are happening that are different from what would have happened before and that you think that the world should be worried.
I think a recent example, just before COVID, really, was the introduction of something called the Citizenship Amendment Act. Now, citizenship in India has never been linked to religion. The entire idea was that anybody with a grandparent born in undivided India, as defined by the Government of India Act 1935 under the British, was eligible for citizenship. Now, some of this got narrowed in that those who had become citizens of Pakistan or Bangladesh had to go through various acid tests later to see if they could qualify, but even they were eligible. Nonetheless, religion was never mentioned, neither in the constitution nor in any law made about it. But for the first time, the government introduced a Citizenship Amendment Act to ostensibly to fast-track citizenship applications by refugees and migrants from our neighboring countries, and specifically spelled out the religions that would be eligible for this fast-tracking. They went from Hinduism, Christianity, Jainism, Buddhism, Sikhism, and conspicuously omitted Islam. And what was striking about this was it was a way of saying to one particular community in India, you are here on sufferance, not by right. You are not in the same category as all these others. When pressed, I opposed this in Parliament, of course, and when pressed by me, the Home Minister took refuge in the argument that partition had taken place on religious grounds and that therefore Muslims were excluded because countries had been created for them. But that is actually equally horrifying because no Indian government before the present one would ever have accepted the logic of partition. The logic of partition rested on the presumption that religion is the determinant of nationhood for India's Muslims in particular. That became the rallying cry, and so Pakistan was created as a country for Muslims. But everybody else, from Mahatma Gandhi to Jawaharlal Nehru to Sardar Patel to Dr. Ambedkar to a Muslim leader like Maulana Azad and many others, said this is wrong. Our freedom struggle has been for everybody. We will create a country for everybody, and religion does not determine our Indianness. That's been the ruling credo. That's been the ethos, and I would argue that's been true to India's inclusive soul for very many years. And suddenly this act coming in effect, pointed a finger at one community and said, you're just not here on the same basis as everybody else. You don't belong in the same way. That's why the Indian edition of the book is called The Battle of Belonging. And that's, I think, what the message was. In any case, there's a concrete example. It was made worse by the threat of the Home Minister to conduct a nationwide exercise in registering all citizens who would be obliged to provide documentary proof of their birth. And you can be reasonably sure that the only ones whose inability to provide such documentation could have had severe consequences were Indian Muslims. So you had this enormous backlash with protests breaking out throughout the country, led by ordinary Muslims, for the most part not averring Islam, but rather their Indianness, and saying, you don't have the right to tell us we're not Indian. And a lot of us came out in support of these protests, which were ended only by the COVID outbreak and the resulting lockdowns.
So an example there of how legislation is changing the secular nature of India in practice, if not necessarily at least in ostensible statement. There have been many interviews here in Britain, for instance, with BJP ministers who have argued that this is something that can be justified under the constitution. You talk about the constitution quite a bit, I know, but in practice it has had an effect of changing the way in which different communities relate to Indianness. But one of the things that people so far have still wanted to say is that India still has, you know, at least one great advantage that many other countries which are turning towards a more authoritarian style of electoral government, you know, Philippines, United States in some ways, it has one advantage, which is the press. There are still liberal voices that can be heard in both English language and Indian language press and media across the country. I think of newspapers like the Calcutta Telegraph, which, you know, I know and have written for on occasion. There are plenty of others too. Could we be confident that the long-standing tradition of a lively and varied media in India will continue to keep government honest?
We hope so, but the performance of the so-called mainstream media has not been encouraging in this regard. And I say this with a lot of regret. I'm a son of a newspaper man, and I'm myself somebody who's been writing for the Indian media since my childhood. And I would hate to see the media go under. But there's been an appalling level of conformity and even abject submission to the government on the part of the best-known mastheads in India. And what was appalling about that is, in fact, the contrasting courage of digital websites, which are really the last refuge now of people like me who want to say things bluntly and be read and heard, because everywhere else, I'm sorry to say, we're seeing that the press has either been cajoled or cudgeled into conformity. We're seeing, by the way, an assault on pretty much all institutions, from universities to the judiciary, to the Independent Election Commission, to the Reserve Bank of India. I mean, you name every institution, and there has been an assault on it by a government quite determined to ensure that criticisms and actions autonomous of the government's wishes are restricted. But the press ought to be calling the government's actions to account. That's historically been the role of the press since the colonial era. And yet it's seemingly been cowed by the overweening power of the government, combining, I would say, intimidation and co-optation, which has ensured that the minimum of critical voices exists in the mainstream media. You'll find the very occasional sort of op-ed by an individual not necessarily associated with the editorial stance of the newspaper. And even those are few and far between in some of the newspapers. There are one or two honorable examples. And so the result of this is that the de-institutionalization of Indian governance is happening, because if the media isn't able to call the spade a bloody shovel, then unfortunately, we are no longer living in a full-fledged democracy.
Well, let's use that term democracy to dig a little bit deeper into the thesis of the book, because just to prove that I have read it with some care, on page 297, Shoshi, you say, and it's a great statement, Indian democracy is a strength, not a weakness. Okay, very happy to accept that. And it is notable that a country of that size and that diversity has managed to keep a cycle of electoral democracy going for so many decades. But in that case, isn't the obvious argument that could come from the government or their many supporters, well, look, this is just democracy. Nobody forced anyone to vote for the BJP. They have a majority in government as mandated by the Constitution of India. No different from Mr. Trump getting elected in America. People complained about him, but he was elected fair and square. He doesn't believe he was de-elected the second time. That's a slightly different question. But in this particular case, isn't what's happened now simply an example of Indian democracy adapting, but still remaining actually perfectly democratic?
Yes and no, because in fact, there have actually been external critics who referred to India as increasingly resembling an elected autocracy. I remember the late Jayaprakash Narayan, the famous socialist Remulan activist, saying that Indian democracy should not consist of the sheep electing their shepherd every 5 years, who then essentially pushes them around as he sees fit. I think it's fair to say that Indian democracy wasn't like that, but it's certainly worrying that it seems to be guided in that direction more and more by a government that seems to believe its democratic credentials rest only on an election victory and not on a need for accountability between elections. That's what's particularly worrying. I mean, you've seen really many interesting arguments around the world that the health of liberal democracies globally is failing and that many consolidated democracies are eroding. You've seen this in Hungary, you've seen it in a number of other countries. I don't want to be invidiously picking names. But in the case of India, what is worrying to me as an Indian Democrat, and of course as a member of the opposition, is precisely, Rana, that we are looking at a situation in which the exercise of a free vote is seen as the only sort of certificate of good housekeeping you need to claim to be a democracy. And everything else that gives substance to the pillars of democracy, the institutions which are the enduring pillars of any true democracy, their independence, integrity, and professionalism, which ought to inure them from the political pressures of the day, are themselves being chopped off literally at the knees. With the results.
Okay, yes.
So that's the answer.
Okay, no, I want to say, no, I mean, that's both an inspiring and eloquent defense of Indian democracy. But again, just to push a little bit, you know, under the surface of that, I think it was actually Dr. Ambedkar who very early on said that Indian democracy is very wide, but also in some ways quite shallow. And I find myself thinking, actually, of course, about your own party in an earlier incarnation back in 1975, where Mrs. Gandhi declared a state of emergency, which again you talk about to some extent in the book, just a reminder to those who don't remember or, you know, are too young, for essentially 2 years, democracy was suspended in India in a way that actually outdoes what's happening now. You know, the press was actually prevented. It was censored and prevented from publishing what it wanted to. Parliament was essentially suspended. J.P. Narayana, who you mentioned, was stuck in jail along with an awful lot of other people on the left, including actually many of the people who became leaders of the BJP. The nearest India has come to dictatorship in the post-independence era was its 2 or 3 years under the secular leader, Mrs. Gandhi. Wasn't that a sign that actually Ambedkar was right, that democracy has always been quite shallow in India and that the paean that you've given has always had a slightly shallow basis
now,
to
I think
it.
What Ambedkar was talking about was social exclusion. What he was saying essentially is you've got undemocratic society which has practiced caste discrimination, particularly against the Dalit community, the so-called untouchables. And on top of that, you are actually imposing a democratic political structure. So you're one man, one vote, but you have one man, one value. I'm actually almost literally quoting his own words. That's what he meant. He wasn't, I think, challenging the kind of democratic institutionalization that I've been celebrating and seeking to defend. He was talking about our society, which of course is problematic. Mrs. Gandhi's emergency, of which I have been a fairly severe critic, I wasn't in the Congress Party at the time. I was a graduate student, but that apart, Mrs. Gandhi's emergency was an aberration. And to her credit, she then called a free and fair election and lost it and surrendered office, not something you see dictators doing.
But she probably called it because she thought she would win it, which, of course, in this day of autocracy, she might do. My point being that if you say aberration, why isn't what we see now an aberration? Why won't things bounce back? Why isn't it for your party, as the official opposition elected to parliament, to essentially make the case to say, look, we have something better that people will vote for?
Very good point. I mean, first of all, we hope it's an aberration. We hope that the public will wake up to the travesties that are being conducted in their name by people who claim to have a mandate to make the mistakes they're making. You know, look at the economy, which has gone from a disastrous demonetization of 86% of India's currency by value, right to the highest unemployment ever recorded since figures were recorded for employment. All of these catastrophes have laid India low at a time when we ought to have been booming before COVID. So the Indian public surely is going to wake up and say, why on earth would we vote for this government when we haven't got jobs, we haven't got a decent life, we were dying from COVID because there wasn't oxygen in the hospitals? What have these people done for us that deserve re-election? That's what we certainly want to bring about, and the opposition will campaign vigorously to remind people of all this. But if the BJP still wins, and remember in India there's elections practically every 6 months because we have 29 states, each of which has its own polls. There are 5 states going to the ballot in February. There'll be another 2 in November next year. So in a sense, there's a constant electoral process in India. But if between those elections or despite those elections, the government manages to not be accountable for all sorts of excesses, from essentially suborning some of the independence of the institutions I've described, to creating, for example, an opaque fund for allegedly monitoring COVID and other humanitarian charitable activities of the Prime Minister, which is not audited by the Controller and Auditor General of India, and so on and so forth. Example after example of new twists. There's a creation of electoral bonds under which the wealthy people can finance political parties anonymously. But of course, there is a serial number on the bonds, so the State Bank of India knows who's bought the bonds. And therefore, it's no great accident that 95 or 98% of those bonds have gone to the ruling party. So you've got one thing after another that didn't happen before, that wasn't part of Indian democracy, and that is increasingly twisting Indian democracy into something that it should not be.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
Shashi, thanks very much indeed. Just a reminder that I'm Rana Mitra. I'm in conversation with Shashi Tharoor, the major Indian public intellectual and politician whose new book, The Struggle for India's Soul, is out now. Let's talk a little bit about Mahatma Gandhi. We talked about Indira Gandhi and the unrelated but also very important Mahatma Gandhi, I think, should come into our conversation. I think you probably, like me, have read the great historian Ram Guha's wonderful two volumes of deeply researched work on Gandhi's life, published in the last few years. And yet, of course, Gandhi himself has become a somewhat controversial figure in India today, in a way that actually the leading figures of the government have made slightly ambivalent, because they haven't rejected him, but they have tried to appropriate him, if that's the right word, for the current Hindutva BJP nationalist message, which you might think was a rather difficult sort of thing to do. And you write about this rather interesting phenomenon in the book. What do you make of
it? Well, I must say that I find it incredible, because I knew something about the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, the movement from which Mr. Modi and indeed the bulk of the ruling party establishment have graduated, as it were. They've all been through the RSS. Many are still officially serving members of it. The RSS has historically preached against Mahatma Gandhi. They had contempt for him when he was alive. Many RSS chapters or shakhas distributed sweets to celebrate his assassination when he was killed. They had contempt for his faith in nonviolence. The famous comment by then head of the RSS that every Hindu god carries weapons, and that Gandhi's himself was completely un-Hindu, and so on and so forth. They certainly had a great deal of withering hostility towards Gandhi for his desire to overcome Hindu-Muslim differences, even during the hatreds unleashed by partition. And the fact that his last fast was actually to get the government of India to give a more generous share of the exchequer to the newly created state of Pakistan, all of this created a tremendous, tremendous amount of hostility to Mahatma Gandhi, which everybody growing up in the RSS has imbibed. Now, Mr. Modi comes to power and realizes that that there's more to sort of winning friends and influencing people around the world than spouting Hindu nationalism, that you need to have a brand image. He managed to sort of be the kind of prime minister who had a threshold, the Shiva strident in one hand, and showed himself clicking a mouse with the other, as it were, this technocratically friendly modern leader whom the West would embrace. And for him, it was very rapidly clear that disowning Mahatma Gandhi was a bad idea, that he would actually gain from Mahatma Gandhi's global muster if he appropriated him instead. But he wasn't particularly welcoming of the content to what Mahatma Gandhi preached. And so what the BJP did was to appropriate Mahatma Gandhi as a symbol of their sanitation movement. The Swachh Bharat or Clean India campaign has adopted Mahatma Gandhi's glasses as their logo because Mahatma Gandhi famously said that sanitation is more important than independence, and they've decided that sanitation is going to be the issue for which Gandhi will be the mascot. Nothing about non-violence, nothing about truth, nothing about Hindu-Muslim unity or amity, nothing about any of the causes for which he fought and lived and died, Mahatma Gandhi got reduced to a figure emblematic of sanitation. Now they're taking it one step further and resurrecting what they say is Mahatma Gandhi's faith in Hinduism. He was indeed a very devout Hindu, absolutely no doubt about that. But he interpreted his Hinduism as one that was inclusive, that was accepting of difference, that had imbibed philosophies from other faiths, including Buddhism and Christianity and Jainism. And therefore, his Hinduism was very far removed from the so-called muscular and rather aggressive Hinduism of today's ruling BJP and Sangh Parivar element. So it's quite paradoxical, this appropriation of Mahatma Gandhi. But it shows, I suppose, that you can pretty much pick and choose anything you like out of anybody and drag him onto your side if you really want to debate cynically.
Well, it has to be said that Gandhi has become an extraordinarily diversely interpreted figure in the last few years. Everyone from various people arguing that his early animus against Africans in particular means that his entire body of thought should be discounted, which ticks to one end. A Marxist critique, which argues that he was never actually the kind of liberator he claimed. And now this sort of semi-appropriation under Hindutva, none of which might have been necessarily interpretations that he would have recognized himself. But of course, we will not know. But I would recommend everyone to read Ram Guha's fantastic two-volume biography of him, which is immensely revealing. Let me pick up one thread of what you said in that answer, Shoshi, about the international influence of Gandhi in terms of shaping India's image. Because I'm speaking to you today from Britain, which I should say, of course, is your place of birth, in fact. You returned to India having been born there. And by the way, there's a wonderful story at the beginning of your book about trying to shake off the necessity to get a British passport by default, which you were entitled to but never took up. In an era where many people are trying to gain citizenship, the idea of not picking it up and deliberately losing it was rather interesting in some ways. But let's speak for a moment about Britain. Britain right now, particularly post-Brexit, defining itself as global Britain, is really spending a lot of time, at least in governmental circles, thinking about India. It sees it as a new trade partner. I mean, whether Mr. Modi sees it the same way is another matter, but, you know, it's under discussion. It sees it as a new security partner, part of what it calls the D10, the group of 10 democracies, the G7 plus South Korea, Japan, India. Part of the Quad, of course, this new military pact, not quite an alliance, but a pact anyway, between Japan, Australia and the United States, along with India. In other words, the rest of the world is looking at Mr. Modi's India, and unlike you, it's saying, well, actually, we can live with this. This is something that actually suits our needs quite well, and we're quite happy to turn these guys a democratic partner with whom we can do business. Are they right?
I don't think they're entirely saying that right. I mean, there's not of what you said is accurate. They reflect an accurate understanding of India's geostrategic importance, particularly in light of the rather belligerent rise of the country you know so well, China. But when you think in terms of what makes India an attractive member of all of these partnerships, it is the fact that it is a democracy. And if it won't, it will actually lose its most fundamental credential for being part of these groups. You can't be in the D10 if you're not really a D, and you can't really be in the kinds of shall we say, resistance to Chinese expansionism brigade, if you are yourself exhibiting the worst qualities that the Chinese have been exhibiting to their minorities, Uyghurs, and so on. Now, in the case of India, we are certainly far, far, far away from being as bad as the Chinese when it comes to the way the Chinese have treated the Uyghurs or the Tibetans or others. So I'm not making the mistake of suggesting there is nothing to choose between the two. But I am saying that there are increasing concerns and even alarm bells being raised about the fact that the Indian government's domestic behavior is not up to the standards that the world has long come to expect of India. That when, for example, Muslims are routinely demonized by people in positions of authority, when shameful incidents occur, for example, of lynchings, of Muslims being beaten and asked to sing the praises of Jai Shri Ram, even as they're dying. You have these horrendous incidents happening, which never seem to get condemned by those who are in power. Then other countries sit up and notice, and they're certainly amongst the India's friends in the Islamic world who are noticing and are expressing their concerns. Bangladesh is a very important neighbor for us, one of the few that are genuinely friendly, and you can't afford to antagonize them, but you are doing so with some of the stories Bangladeshis are reading about what's going on in India. The Kuwait National Assembly recently passed a hostile critical resolution about India's mistreatment of its Muslims. In the Gulf countries where Indians are actually finding themselves a home, a job, and a source of remittances, can you afford to antagonize all of these countries? And then when it comes to the Western world, it was no real accident that Mr. Modi shows up in America and Vice President Kamala Harris, instead of merely celebrating her ethnic affinity to the visiting prime minister, because she is of Indian origin, her mother was Indian, instead lectures him on the importance of democracy. But I think the messages are fairly clear. Everyone values India, recognizes India's extremely special place in the world, wants to be able to welcome and embrace India, and is begging India, for God's sake, don't make it difficult for us to do so by your own behavior, conduct, and statements at home. And I think that's actually a pretty reasonable proposition that Indian officials ought to pay attention to.
Thanks, Shashi. I see that questions are pouring in, so I'm going to put one last one just to round off this part of the discussion for a brief question, brief answer. And it is essentially about where we go next. Now, the way I have seen this is something that has a half glass full or half glass empty interpretation, which is that, as actually in previous eras of Congress dominance, a lot of the pushback against central government politics in India comes from the east and from the south, your own southern homelands, Karnataka, Kerala, Tamil Nadu, and of course West Bengal. And you could look at West Bengal, which recently did not let the BJP actually win government in that state. The ruling Trinamool Congress, separate from the Congress party, won again. But there was a significant advance in BJP voting there. So for those like you who want to push back, do those parts of India that haven't yet become dominated by the BJP merely provide a kind of sign of things to come? Or are they actually the anvil for something that might be a different sort of politics later on?
Well, I have no doubt in my own mind that, in fact, the parts of the country which have so far remained immune to the BJP's advances are actually the parts of the country that will continue to resist the BJP, which is increasingly being seen and being reduced to being in the heartland party. In fact, it has only one state in the south, Karnataka, and every indication is it is not going to be able to hold on to it beyond this one term. It is attempting to spread in the northeast, but frankly, facing many contradictions over the fact that it is often relying on local partners who don't share any.
But it increased its seats in Bengal last time.
It increased its seats in Bengal, true, but it has also failed to pull off the victory that it thought its efforts and its colossal expenditure would have justified. And strikingly, a number of the opportunists who had jumped ship from the ruling party, the Trinamool, to join the BJP for the elections, have quietly turned tail and come back after the elections, including some who won their seats under the BJP and are now regretting having joined that party. So I think it is a Hindi heartland party. What's particularly worrying, Rana, and I mentioned this in a later part of the book, is the fact that we have an unusual arrangement whereby the political constituencies in the lower house of parliament have been delimited in accordance with the proportions of the 1971 census in an arrangement through a constitutional amendment that will lapse in 2026. All indications are that the BJP will not want to renew that amendment and will instead want to stack the deck to reflect the changes in population over the last five decades, which have dramatically increased the population of those states that have failed to empower their women and curb population growth. And those are precisely the Hindi heartland states where the BJP thrives. And you may suddenly find a situation where the South, Bengal, these states that are resisting the BJP are in effect disenfranchised in parliament because the Hindi heartland suddenly as a result of sheer demographics, gets a two-thirds majority in the House. And that's a very worrying thing that I've flagged in the book, which we have to watch out for in the next few years.
Aside, there are many, many aspects of Indian politics that we'll have to keep a close eye on in the next few years. I want to break in there just because it's time for us to get our huge audience from around the world to take part in this conversation as well. I know they're dying to get in, Shoshi. Right, let's get to some of these questions, Shoshi, because a lot of things that people want to ask you. We've got a general message from William Mora, who's saying, greetings from Venezuela, just to prove we genuinely are very global today. And here's a question, I think, from, well, a friend of both of ours, I have to say. Gosh, this, but I'm going to cheat and put him in first here. Dom Ziegler from The Economist magazine, who we have to have because he's currently sitting in Uzbekistan in Tashkent. And he is asking on the question of institutions, Shoshi, would your criticism of the press also apply to the Supreme Court? And just as in the US, for those who don't know, the makeup of the Indian Supreme Court has become quite a politically controversial issue in India recently. So Shoshi, over to you.
I'm sorry to say that it now does a little bit. I mean, the one difference in the US Supreme Court is that in the US Supreme Court, you're appointed for life. And in the Indian Supreme Court, you have to retire when you hit a particular age, I think it's 65. And therefore, if judges are particularly either craven or independent, time will take care of them, as it were, eventually. But there have been a number of criticisms that the performance of the last few chief justices has reduced what used to be a fiercely independent apex court to an executive court, subserving the government's agenda. And I'm not saying this. Legal luminaries have written articles and learned essays making this argument. And the problem here is that if you have a Supreme Court that seems ever ready to oblige the government, in a slew of cases, I might add, and then the Chief Justice of that court, upon retirement, accepts a nominated seat in the upper house from the same government he has obliged in his judgments, without even a cooling-off period in between, then you really do worry about whether the institution has become one that not just serves the interests of the executive, but speaks its language. And this is something you can't afford to have a Supreme Court that's indistinguishable from the executive. The current Supreme Court Chief Justice has been getting a good press, and we all hope it lasts, though there are some cases before him that I think everyone is anxious to see, you know, courageous responses to by the court. But frankly, it's the judiciary and the media, the two institutions you've asked about, Rana, that for many of us represent the only hope other than electoral victory for the opposition, which of course is many years away. These are the institutions that absolutely need to stay alive and keep the flame of Indian democracy alive.
Well, there's several questions that are coming. I'm going to kind of put them together, if I may, because they make up a sort of suite of questions on a similar area about the possibility of the government changing. And obviously, as an opposition politician, at one level, you're literally parti pris, but also you're at the centre of the fight. So let me put these here. Anonymous attendee says, is there a realistic possibility that the BJP will be voted out of power at the centre of the next general election? I don't think this is Mr. Modi secretly writing to us, because it then says, given the economic underperformance and divisive nature of the agenda, but then says the Hindutva doctrine seems to catch the masses given the shambolic nature of the opposition. And then before you come back and tell us why that, I'm sure that's not right. Martin Yule from Manchester says, what hope does Congress offer people in rural India that the BJP does not? And then the final one that sort of comes under this heading, Robert G.H. from North London says, has not Indian democracy under the Congress Party and others failed? Witness the continuing profound and widespread poverty. If so, is not radical change needed?
All right. So that's a lot of questions. Let me just get on to the rural one right away by saying that the Congress Party is the party that actually introduced the Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme, which was opposed, attacked, and derided by Mr. Modi when he became Prime Minister in a famous speech saying that we will preserve this scheme as a monument to all the decades of your failure. In the end, he ended up relying on the scheme to bail him out when he was unable to improve the economy and generate any jobs. It was the Congress-created scheme that guarantees 100 days of paid employment to at least one member of every rural family below the poverty line that actually won the day and that has kept people from living hand to mouth, number one. Number two, in rural India, every one of Mr. Modi's welfare schemes has been lifted lock, stock, and barrel from the Congress. So the BJP isn't doing something the Congress wouldn't do. And number three, the thing about the Congress party in rural India is that it has always showed, some would say, an excessive respect for India's agricultural community, the farmers in particular, and landless labor. No taxation on agriculture, for example, which is an interesting challenge. And purchasing by government-owned corporations of crops at a minimum support price. The BJP, by passing three farm laws that essentially privatize the purchase and distribution of agriculture, has, in the view of many farmers, placed rural incomes at the mercy of urban capitalists. And so they're up in arms against the BJP. The entire farming belt across northern India is hostile to it. So on the question of what does the BJP offer rural India, not very much by comparison with what the opposition stands for. The Congress party has also come up with a scheme called NYAY, which is about a guaranteed minimum income to every poor Indian, something like 20% to India's families. It is a very major giveaway. And I'm sure some economists would consider it irresponsible and so on. But the truth is that that's something that the Congress victory would bring that the BJP will not be able to match. On the related question of radical change, well, if you're a Democrat, you get radical change for the ballot box. If the questioner implied, any sympathy for the Maoists or the Naxalites who foolishly taken up the gun in some of our rural areas, in a rather futile but deeply destructive effort to bring about that kind of radical change, I'm afraid I have no sympathy for that. I think that ultimately ours is a country where change is best brought about through persuasion and electoral victories. And that brings me back to the original, the first question you asked of the three, which is, of course, the toughest one to answer. Is there any realistic prospect of the opposition unseating the BJP? I'd like to think there is, simply because the BJP's failures are so self-evident that it's difficult to pretend they aren't there. I mean, on the economy, I mentioned already demonetization, unemployment, every kind of economic collapse you can imagine has been visited upon us. On the social fabric, you have seen the rending, the rending of the social fabric with a terrible level of divisiveness and particularly an insecurity for minorities that is deeply, deeply worrying those of us in India who do not judge people by how they raise their hands in worship, but rather by the content of their character, to borrow from Martin Luther King. And that, unfortunately, is another part of the BJP's gift to India. And so I think that most people have already endured all of that. And then the last straw in many parts of India was the mismanagement of COVID, where poor families were even literally floating the corpses of their loved ones down the river Ganges because they couldn't afford to pay for cremations. And indeed, the backlog for cremations in any case was so long, it was unsustainable for many. Now, that's the kind of situation that the government's mismanagement of the economy and of COVID has brought about. And on top of that, it has looked particularly feckless and inept on the border as China has nibbled away at the northern frontier. So with all of this going on, why on earth the BJP would get reelected? It's difficult to explain. The usual defense is the TINA factor. There is no alternative. I think it's incumbent upon the opposition to demonstrate convincingly and clearly that there is an alternative, and it consists of decent people, experienced people who actually believe in inclusive governance.
Shushi, in the recent past, your name has been mooted as a potential prime ministerial candidate for the Congress party. Is that something of interest at all?
There's no politician who says it's not of interest, but it's not realistic. It's a good deal less realistic than turfing the BJP out of office. The party I belong to has a settled leadership. I do believe, however, that there should be an opposition coalition. There should be unity across the opposition, because people often forget when celebrating Mr. Modi's electoral mandate that he won the first time with 31% of the vote and the second with 37% of the vote in a first-past-the-post system. in which the vast majority of Indian voters rejected him, but their votes were fragmented across 45 regional, local and other national parties. So if we can construct a sensible national opposition coalition, I genuinely believe we can defeat Mr. Modi. And at that point, who heads or chairs it is something that the victors would have to decide. Right now, I think what's at stake is really India's soul. And that's what I want to fight for.
Well, let me bring in again a couple of questions on a similar issue, which I think get to an important area that we've only just touched on briefly. So chance to have a quick answer on this. One comes from the distinguished writer on India, Victoria Schofield, who says, greetings from London. And she says, we all know the history of fractious Indo-Pakistani relations. Do you think the current Indian government is making more than the usual hostility to gain popularity amongst the BJP constituents in India? And another one that comes from anonymous attendee, and I don't know why she or he is being anonymous, because they start, brilliant presentation. Thank you for your honesty. Maybe that's why. Can you comment on Prime Minister Modi's use of the traditional hostility which exists with Pakistan to gain domestic support? So a couple of questions there on the relationship with Pakistan. And I just add, and you'll remember this, Shoshi, right at the beginning of his first term, Mr. Modi actually made some outreach to Pakistan, which was rather unusual and made people think that maybe he was going to be a sort of Nixon to China type person who would be able to actually mend the relationship. That doesn't seem to be where it's gone in recent years.
Right. Well, there's a lot to be said on that. I think in all fairness to Mr. Modi, he did somewhat whimsically and impulsively surprise the nation by dropping in an unannounced, unplanned visit to Nawaz Sharif in Lahore, I think it was, and quite unexpectedly, because he was on his way back from Kabul to Delhi. He called Nawaz Sharif on a courtesy call to wish him a happy birthday. Nawaz said, why don't you pop by and celebrate it with me? And my granddaughter's getting married the same day. You're welcome at the wedding. And Modi said, why not? And popped over. And then after that sort of feel-good experience, followed up by when there was a bomb attack, and a rather nasty terrorist attack, on an Indian Air Force base in a place called Pathankot, he then actually invited Pakistani intelligence to inspect the site for itself, to satisfy itself of the information that India had provided, because the Pakistanis used to have a habit of denying every terrorist attack emanating from their soil, even though it's pretty obvious where most of these attacks are actually mounted from. So to Mr. Modi's credit, he made those two gestures, which were undoubtedly rebuffed by Pakistan, and that the visit to Mr. Nawaz Sharif on the 25th of December was followed by an attack in the middle of January on Pathankot and subsequent other terrorist raids that were seen as having emanated from Pakistan. And you can't entirely blame Mr. Modi from having turned cold, shall we say, and abandoning any peaceful overtures to Pakistan. Then after, however, what is striking is that there was this rather ill-timed from the point of view of the Indian opposition, but also tragic from the point of view of any patriotic Indian, attack on an army convoy in Kashmir just before the 2019 general elections, which killed 40 of our soldiers. And that gave Mr. Modi a chance to conduct a bombing raid across the border, what he described as a terrorist training camp, and then essentially run to electoral victory by thumping his chest and saying, I'm the guy who can deal with Pakistan in its own terms. So that, in many ways, may have actually pulled off a win that didn't look so likely before that terrorist attack, because he had really already created the disaster of demonetization. Unemployment was already rife, and there were economic setbacks that could have led people to say, we want to change again. But this particular thing clinched an election for him. And the BJP then realized that this is a very good issue for them to hold on to. So all of those who are asking whether he is deliberately stoking tensions with Pakistan, I would say that the initial era was not his. Indeed, one can even go back further to his own inauguration in 2014, to which he invited all the prime ministers of the neighborhood, including the Pakistani, and treated them very well. So he did start off wanting to make peace on the subcontinent. But subsequently, they have seen the electoral advantages of stoking a certain level of belligerent rhetoric towards Pakistan in particular, which serves a twin purpose of demonizing an enemy and discrediting India's Muslims by association. So in many ways, it's fed into a certain narrative of the government.
I'm just jumping in, Trisha, because time is beginning to creep upon us, but there's a couple more questions I definitely want to get in for quick questions and quick answers. One is actually just to also answer a point that someone made in the chat. The books that were mentioned about Gandhi are the two volumes by Ramachandra Guha, G-U-H-A, available through, I think, Penguin Books in India and elsewhere. So if you haven't read those, buy Shoshi's book, but also please do buy those. They're both excellent. A question that comes in from Catherine in India, in fact. Basic, very good question, but boiled down, she asks it in a more polite way than I'm going to do. A lot of people said that in the 2019 election, one point of difference was that the Congress Party's social media effort amongst the electorate was dire, and the BJP, whatever you say about them, their Hindi language social media engagement, particularly with women voters, was absolutely superb. Fair indictment? Not fair indictment.
I think in 2014, it is a fair indictment. The Congress Party was simply not there. I'm proud to say that until July 2013, I was India's most followed politician on Twitter. So, I actually had stuck my neck out, but the rest of my party had refused to follow. The BJP, particularly Mr. Modi, who was a man who overtook me in July 2013, rapidly realized that this was an extremely useful tool for them, because at that point, they were the ones who felt the mainstream media were biased against them, and they actually found an opportunity to use social media to turn the tables, as it were, on the mainstream received opinion. Having said that, I'm not sure it's still true anymore, and I would argue that even though social media is certainly liable to misuse, to publishing extremist points of view, to airing bigotry, and so on, I would say that now social media is a platform on which, by and large, the Hindutva ecosystem around the BJP gets as good as it gives. I think that there is now also there are strong liberal voices that are resisting some of it. So I would not say that it's a completely uneven playing field on social media. Where the BJP is very good is on things like organizing WhatsApp groups. Their version of history gets out in mediums and ordinary people's phones and on devices and on apps like WhatsApp, which have completely, I think we haven't been able to match that, the resources.
No, that's true. And there's me recommending Penguin Books, which maybe is not the way of the future. One last question to get in here. It's a big one, but I'm going to ask you to give it your best shot in the most concise way as we come up to time. But I think it is important. One thing that a lot of outside observers would say about India today in terms of its international relationships is that in terms of two really important international engagements with the United States, particularly under both Trump and Biden, and with China, the current Indian government has taken stances that many people outside broadly think seem to make sense. You know, warmth towards the United States in a way that was less true in the Cold War, and a certain amount of toughness towards China on border issues. Is there anything that you know, either as you or as a Congress member, would change in terms of India's current stance towards those two immensely important, or they're rather different, relationships, US and China?
Foreign policy has always largely been a consensual subject in India, in the sense that we have tended, by and large, to let our political differences sort of fade away at the water's edge. India's relations with the US actually been bipartisan on both ends. That is, in America, it didn't matter which party came to power or won the White House. In India, it didn't matter which party came to power. We tended to work in the same direction towards strengthening Indo-US relations. China, there has been a difference, and it's more of a difference, I think, of competence than of substance. India's, both governments, the Congress government of the previous 10 years and the Modi government of the last seven, taken the view that we can't afford to be part of a sort of containment strategy against China or to ally ourselves in overt hostility to China, because we need them not least for trade. They're one of our largest trade partners. I think we're forced to cross $100 billion in trade this year already, and we're only in October. So China is important, plus it's a next-door neighbor. We'd have to live with them whether we like it or not. It's not a country far away that we can afford to have a Cold War with, and so on. So there's been that. At the same time, we're very conscious that China has been nibbling away at our frontiers in the north, that China sees us in a much less friendly light than we see, than we would like them to see us, let's put it that way, and that some of our nostalgic sentimentalism about traditional millennial ties with China are not particularly shared or appreciated on the other side. So given all of that, India has been navigating a slightly complicated set of attitudes. The Modi government has really had a couple of major diplomatic setbacks on the frontier and Bhutan, the Doklam frontier, and now most recently last year, the Galwan Valley, and the humiliation of 20 Indian soldiers being killed by the Chinese, and the Prime Minister lying to the Indian public and saying that no Indian posts have been occupied. All of that has been truly shocking and dismaying. But we stay united on the fundamental questions of national interests. So I won't go beyond that, except to say that we just hope that if we were handling these policies rather than the present government, we might show a little more experience and competence and bring them into service on these matters.
Concisely put and beautifully timed, Shoshi. Thank you for that. And we're coming towards the end. I'd like to thank our speaker, Shoshi Tharoor, and remind you again that his new book is The Struggle for India's Soul. Unless you're in India, where it has a different title, you're saying, Shoshi.
If you're
in India, as some of our...
The Battle
for Belonging. There you are. So you can even buy it twice with two different titles. Thank you, our audience from around the world, whether you're in Venezuela, Tashkent, India, or North London. Who knows which is the most remote of any of those, depending where you start, I suppose. Great to have you with us. And many thanks to Intelligence Squared for organising this.
Thank you, Rana, for your very able conducting of this somewhat unruly conversation. Much appreciated. Thank you.